21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your
command. Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now. Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer is Laura Kortner, and our engineer is Kristen Hagerich. Oh, there they go. Thank you, young bloods. Well, on the night of September the 12th, 1952, a shocked American public sought answers when strange, unidentified objects were seen flying through the sky over Washington, D.C. and the eastern United States, up and down the East Coast. Police stations, newspapers, airports, military bases, and the Pentagon were besieged with calls from frantic citizens. One of the strange objects crash-landed on the rural hilltop in Flatwoods, West Virginia. A group of schoolboys saw the object maneuver across the sky and seemingly fall to Earth. Was it a meteor, plane, or anything they could explain? Well, the boys and two adults headed off to look for the object. Soon, a 12-foot-tall being from the downed craft terrified these innocent people. This being came known as the Flatwoods Monster or the Braxton County Monster. Now, this 2012 revised edition book by the author-illustrator Frank C. Fascino, Jr. contains new information about the Braxton County Monster case and has more than 200 visuals, including unseen photos, articles, graphics, maps, and illustrations, which credit it as the most detailed account of the case to date. Fascino's ongoing 20-year investigation reveals a startling invasion, a precise time, yes, of gigantic extraterrestrial beings that occurred on September 12th, as I noted before. He reconstructs a precise timeline of events and recreates the frightening scenario, which includes the Braxton Monster, Braxton County Monster, incident, and the Frametown Monster encounter, the Wheeling, West Virginia, which used to be my favorite station, Bashful Billy monsters, and conspiracies and cover-ups. And you can learn what the government has held back from the American public since 1952, that we're not alone in the universe. Well, our listeners over the past quarter of a century realize that. Now, friends, one of the most difficult problems of 21st Century Radio is its programming. We have scores of previous and new guests that have been waiting patiently to either join us for the first time in 25 years or have been waiting to return. Well, why is that? Well, some say, at least this is what I'm told, the reason is simple. I read their books, their research. I read their papers and listen to their music. And we are told repeatedly by them, and I don't know if this is true, that I may be the only radio host that actually reads and studies their work. Now, that may be or may not be true. But what happens when you've already spent, well, 3 to 4 days studying their work, and years later they republished their book because of the difficulties created by their first publisher, who did a poor job of getting their facts straight. Now, this happens more often than you think. I know many authors that go through this. Tonight's author, Frank C. Fascino Jr., joined us 8 years ago to review his book, The Braxton County Monster, The Cover-Up of the Flatwoods Monster, revealed. Frank's revised edition of the Braxton County Monster does indeed merit a second look because his publisher had really done him wrong. They didn't even name the person who wrote the foreword to his 2004 edition, and that's a great oversight because it was, and still is, the nuclear physicist Stanton T. Friedman, who's joined us repeatedly on 21st Century Radio over the past quarter of a century. So far, our previous and new guests waiting to join us. I hope, folks, just be patient. I understand why, and now I think you'll understand why he's joining us tonight before you came on. I thought he deserved an explanation of all this complications that we receive here on 21st Century Radio. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Frank.
You. Glad to be here. Been a long time.
Yes, it is. Eight years.
We can settle stuff up the right way.
Well, I was, you know, this case I've been fascinated with for, oh my gosh, 30 years or so. And I knew something was, there was something to it, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And I think I had a heck of a lot of it had to do with the original drawings that some artist did in our television studio that kind of misled everybody along those lines. Frank, why was a revised edition of your book an absolute necessity?
Well, what had happened basically is my finished book, as it was supposed to go into print, the final galley, as I okayed it, was changed and rearranged and basically butchered, as I wrote in my intro, and it really was, Dr. Bob. The book had actually 154 documented mistakes in it. Whoa. The publisher went ahead after I had given the okay to put the book out, and he edited the book one more time with a team of people. And subsequently, 154 mistakes, which were typos, mislabeled maps, lists were edited wrong, very amateurish editing. It looked like a bunch of kindergarten kids actually did it. And the storyline was wrong. It was botched up. And I actually walked off book tour. And it was kind of embarrassing because I had driven from Florida up to West Virginia. And the people were coming up and buying the first book, and they were reading it, and they heard me on several different talk shows, and they said, well, how come you didn't put that in the book, Frank? That's a key point. You know, you said that on the radio a couple nights ago, and I'm like, what do you mean? That's a key point. You're right. And they were opening up the book and saying, well, show me where it is. Mm-hmm. And that happened for quite a while, and when I finally had realized what was going on, I just walked off tour.
Well, bravo to you, because it gave you 8 more years to do a better book.
Absolutely. And this time I did the whole thing. And being an illustrator, it was a big help. I did all my own maps, illustrations. I'm a photographer, videographer. I kind of did the whole thing. And that's why it was so disappointing, because I worked for so many years on this. And, you know, I have a good team of people behind me who supported me with the first book. And they were as disappointed as I was, including Stan Friedman.
Yeah, he was.
You know, our names are on that book, and it was being pushed all over the world. And when I realized what was going on, it was an absolute disgrace. And so, actually, the book will never go into print again. We had a settlement agreement out of court, and the book will never go into print again.
Well, I'm glad.
Which is a good thing.
I'm glad you really worked on this and put it back together, because now a lot of things that I couldn't quite put together, I can. And, well, okay, let's get going here. It's 1952. President Truman is our commander-in-chief. What kind of challenges did the president face in regards to America's security and also in regards to our terrestrial and extraterrestrial beings?
Well, 1952 is actually the record year for UFO reports, reports that were sent to Project Blue Book. They were in charge of the investigation and the value of these UFO reports, Air Technical Intelligence Center, from 51 to 69. 1952 had the highest amount of reports. There was 1,501 reports. And of those 1,501 reports, there was 303 unknowns. And a key point here, Dr. Bob, is during the summer of 52, which has been called the summer of the saucers, between June and September, of the 1,501 reports, 1,134 reports took place just during the summer, and 111 unknowns. And the Flatwoods Monster case, we're going to call it Flatwoods Monster because it really wasn't a monster for namesake, that incident happened on September 12, 1952, at the tail end of the summer. And a very key and important part of this whole story here is we had the flyovers over Washington back-to-back weekends, and then we also had a third flyover not too many people are familiar with, where jet interceptors were sent out on August 5th. So it was actually 3 consecutive weekends. And during that time, it was revealed by the Air Force, there was orders to shoot flying saucers down, to shoot them down if you couldn't talk them down. And this happened 6 weeks prior to the Flatwoods case, where I was able to identify four damaged aircraft. UFOs came in over the United States, three over the mid-Atlantic part of the United States, and crashed repeatedly throughout the country.
We'll get to
that. So that's kind of a little introduction of what was going on. We had a lot of stuff going on in 52. The Cold War was at its height. Truman and the Air Defense Command were, you know, hot on the edge of their seats. There were scrambles going on every day around the United States. So it was not unusual for these for the Air Defense Command to be scrambling jets all the time. And that's what was going on. They were, you know, spring-loaded, ready to go, and they were chasing flying saucers.
Frank, how in the world were they going to talk these UFOs down?
That's a good question.
How absurd.
Yeah, it really is ridiculous. It's basically a shoot first and ask questions later.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Flatwoods case, I think the Air Defense Command and the president had learned that if you shoot at these UFOs and there was a chance that you hit them, and on this particular night, I believe that's what happened, because we had four of them damaged come in, and the government saw what was actually inside these crafts, and one of them was such the case, the Flatwoods Monster.
Well, we're going to get to that. I've got other preliminary questions here first, because I think that it's important for our listeners to understand what the generalities first before we go into the specifics, because it's really an exciting piece of work that you've done. Would you give us a kind of a summary of how the Braxton County Monster or the Flatwoods Monster was viewed before you published your two editions, and how the media and government viewed it?
Well, the United States government, the official explanation is that it was an owl in a tree, probably an owl in a tree. It's the most ridiculous thing you can ever imagine. And this was all attributed to what was called the well-known Washington area meteor. And this meteor was actually flew over Washington, D.C., supposed meteor, and had a duration of 5 to 6 seconds. Well, I worked outside of the Flatwoods area checking newspaper articles, all types of sources, magazine articles. I got out the Project Blue Book documents for September 12, 1952. And it was amazing. Dr. Bob, the whole microfilm reel for September 12th, I thought it was going to be just a few pages in there for like the whole month. It was almost the whole microfilm reel for just what had happened that one particular night. It was amazing. So I was able to establish that it was not a meteor that flew over Washington that was seen for 5 to 6 seconds. It was actually 21 hours of sustained UFO sightings over the United States. And I was able to pinpoint 102 locations on 9 East Coast states where these UFOs were sighted. And there was actually sightings in the Santa Monica area, California, simultaneous to when everything hit full steam here on the East Coast. And there was a lot of action going right over in the Baltimore area, too. It was amazing.
That we'll touch again on in just
a
little
while. Yeah, we could do a real good segment on that.
Well, I just want to let our listeners know that it wasn't some child that thought up the idea that it was some owl's eyes. It was a fellow from a group called PsyCop, and these guys really have amazed me with their mistakes, one mistakes after another. It was a Nichols? Was it a Dr. Nichols?
Yeah, Joe Nichols. He's the head skeptic.
Yeah, he did a poor job, I'm telling you. How in the world? He said it was an owl sitting on the limb of a tree.
And that was the eyes that the witnesses saw.
Yes, and that was the eyes. Well, now, in both editions of your book, you believe that a cover-up of this event had taken place. What were the reasons you had come to that conclusion?
Well, first of all, the explanation given in the Flatwoods, it's actually called the Project 10073 Record Card, and that was the official data of the conclusions that were drawn by Project Blue Book, the intelligence guys up there, Ed Ruppelt and his crew of guys, said that this was a meteor. It was a fireball meteor. And all the sightings that took place over the United States that night were because of one meteor. Well, Project Blue Book is the only place on the planet Earth where there's an official document for a meteor sighting. There were none that night.
That's right.
And the official explanation was this meteor seen 5 to 6 seconds, and I have 21 hours of sustained sightings over 102 locations. So that was, must have been one hell of an active meteor, like a pinball in a pinball machine bouncing around for 21 hours. What I actually did is when I started, what got me going was the Project Blue Book documents, and they were the tentative observers questionnaires where people would see a UFO. What they would do is they would write into the Air Force. They would send them this several-page document, and they would fill in how big was the object, was it on fire, all these the pages of questions, and they would send it back in, and they would evaluate it. Well, I started looking at these pages. There's countless pages I was going through, and it was amazing how many different locations this alleged meteor was sighted over different, 9 different states all at the same time. And they were flying, several of them, Dr. Bob, were at treetop level. Several had landed. There were pieces exploding off of them. These things were sparkling. They were on fire and making repeated landings. So being an illustrator, what I did is I started segregating all these different sightings, plotting the points, and drawing illustrations of these different objects. And in the long run, I was able to establish that there was 25 different UFOs seen over the United States during that 21-hour period, and 4 were damaged. 3 came in over the eastern seaboard and split and went in 3 different directions, and a damaged craft came from the Florida direction, flew over North Carolina, Virginia, and into West Virginia. And when I started looking into the Blue Book files, that got me on the path to look into those particular states. And I started contacting newspapers around the country. And I started pinpointing locations and putting this whole thing together. I worked with retired military guys who assisted me with this. I had 9 different East Coast maps with all these pinpointed dots where all these locations took place. And I transferred all of them to a giant master map is what I call it. And you could see it on my website, flatwoodsmonster.com, on my homepage. It's a quick link, and if you click on it, you will see that master map. It's the size of a wall. It's a big wall hanging. I transferred all the data onto this master map, and I put all the dots. And working with the military fellas, they basically figured it out first, quicker before me, because I don't have a military background, but I've learned a lot about the military, I tell you that. We stood there and we looked at this map, and one fellow looked at me and he said, "Frank, do you know what the hell you have here?" And I really didn't, because you're looking at something with 102 locations, and I started figuring part of it out. Well, that's when we started connecting the dots. And
we're going to get to connect more and more dots as we go on here. We need to take our first break. Our guest is Frank Ficino Jr., and this is the book is called The Braxton County Monster Revised Edition, The Cover-Up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed 2012. Go to flatwoodsmonster.com, flatwoodsmonster.com.
This is Timothy Good, author of Above Top Secret, Alien Contact, and Alien Base, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Well, that's Baltimore's Telesma, indeed. And our guest is Frank Ficino Jr., The Braxton County Monster Revised Edition, The Cover-Up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed 2012, flatwoodsmonster.com. Now, the important thing, there are many important things about this book. I think Frank has done the most important research I've ever seen in this area. others who have done research in this area, especially Ivan T. Sanderson, really got the ball rolling. But Frank, you spent years, if I understand, analyzing the Blue Book accounts of this time period, didn't you?
Yeah, the whole project is over 20 years right now,
but
on this one particular night.
Yeah, on that one particular night. Now, I've got 20 some more questions, and we're going to have to move a little bit more quickly here, and it's my fault because I just enjoyed this so much. Now, who were the most important people you interviewed that convinced you that there was much more to the Flatwoods Monster case than just a monster?
Actually intrigued me the most, Dr. Bob, is when I started my research years ago, 19, 20 years ago, when I was going into the area, first of all, I was an outsider, even though I had relatives up there. I'm originally from Connecticut, and I just opened my mouth up, and people looked at me like I had three heads,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want to talk to me. And it was the reactions of the people that really intrigued me with this story, because, you bring up Flatwoods or Braxton County Monster, and they just, look at you funny, and a few choice words were said to me about, we don't fool with this story up here no more, don't bother with it. And nobody would tell me anything about it. So I started researching into this story, and I was grabbing UFO magazines, books, going into the New Age sections of bookstores, and I found tons of different stories about the Flatwoods Monster, and no two of them were the same. The story had changed so much over the years. It was unbelievable. I eventually contacted Kathleen May. She was the primary adult witness who actually came within about 12 to 14 feet of this monster, so-called monster. And I started working with her, and along the early parts of my research, that's when I obtained the Blue Book microphone, and I was taking the stuff out, and I was putting it all together, trying to figure out what happened that night. And simultaneously, I was contacting Mrs. May constantly, talking to her. And I met her, we sat down, and I laid out all the Blue Book documents, and I showed her the official explanations. And she put me in touch with Colonel Dale Levitt. Levitt was a World War II hero. He fought in the South Pacific and different parts of the world. And when he came back after World War II, he became the head of the West Virginia National Guard. Well, Colonel Levitt, it was well known he was up there with his National Guard troops for crowd control, because this story hit so big, Dr. Bob, it was estimated in the first 4 to 6 weeks, Flatwoods, the little town, which is a geographical center of the state, had approximately 10,000 people went into that little tiny town within the first 4 to 6 weeks, and it was unbelievable. It was known that Levitt and troops were up there for crowd control. Well, I spoke to Levitt. Mrs. May contacted him, and I spoke to him a couple times, and we met. And he took me up onto the Bailey Fisher farm where this incident happened, and I didn't tape him. He wouldn't let me tape him whatsoever, but I took notes. And he told me a lot about what was going on, and the thing that really hit me and knocked me over was he told me that he was not up there just for crowd control in the following days after the incident. He was actually up there that night, later that night. He told me he received a call from Washington, D.C. The Air Force personnel had contacted him, and he was told to go up to the Bailey Fisher farm. And he actually gathered 180 troops together, and there was actually two points where two separate UFOs had went down that night. One was in Flatwoods, and the other one was about 14, 15 miles away in the area of Sugar Creek. That was the UFO that was damaged that came up from the direction of Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, into central West Virginia. And it actually passed over the Bailey Fisher farm and circled around it, and then took off and went down the Elk River, and it went southwest, and it crashed along the Elk River on the far sides of the banks, and people thought it was a Piper Cub that went down. Well, anyways, when Levitt was contacted by the Air Force, he was told to go into the two areas of interest. He went and set the troops up, he told me in the interview. Let me add, after the first interview, I contacted him again, and it was kind of like pulling teeth to get him to talk to me on camera, and he eventually did talk to me in front of a video camera. That was our second meeting up on the farm, and I stood in front of him with a camera, and he told me everything that, as far as I know, what happened that night. He had 180 troops over at Sugar Creek. They went up there with several Army trucks, and they had boats, and they went across, paddled across the Elk River, and they were looking for this thing that had crashed just along the banks, along the top of the ridge.
We'll get back to that a little later, but I wanted to make sure I understood this. Was Colonel Dale Levitt the individual that had in his possession some little pieces of, some remnants of what might have been part of this crash?
Yeah, he had picked up some pieces of this black plastic-like material that was strewn along the farm. There was oil all over the place. There
oil.
Was a big puddle of oil. They called it an oily-like substance. It was some type of a liquid. It didn't have the consistency of oil, but it was a little bit thicker. And this is what was leaked from the monster. It was splattering, leaking this out all over the field. There was a puddle of it by the tree. And where this thing was sitting after it came out of its craft, it had splattered oil throughout the whole back portion of the woods where this big oak tree was. That's where the monster hovered next to it. And Levitt told me he gathered up the oil. He was told to get whatever samples. He found some metal that night and some of this black plastic-like material. He told me he got the where the tree was, the big white oak tree. He says he grabbed some of the leaves off, dug some of the soil around. And it was interesting because when I asked Colonel Levitt, I said, how long were you up here for? And he said he was up there for about 45 minutes.
He did all that in 45
minutes. And then
he
added, but my troops were up here overnight, and I was shocked by that. I said, they stayed overnight? And he said, yes, to see if anything else was going to happen.
Well, black plastic and some of the other, the oil and other things, he had something to do with passing them on to the military. Pardon me?
He said he shifted them back off. The Air Force wanted the samples.
And he never found out. They never told him what the results were.
Exactly. I said, I said, Colonel, I said, did they ever give you the results? And he says, no, they never do.
They never do. Well, I was really I was really struck by that. I mean, obviously, this is one of our heroes in the military, and he certainly did his job. And unfortunately, I don't think he was treated well by them. But that's my opinion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got to get to the point of this because there's a lot of stuff that I wanted to make sure we presented in a certain way, and that is, what is the coastal ADIZ, or Air Defense Identification Zone, and what happens to aircraft when they fly within that airspace?
The Air Defense Identification Zone is where the presence of an aircraft has to identify themselves coming through this, file a flight plan according to protocol, and when you go through this area and you're nearing the United States, you have to identify yourself. That's a lot of problems we have with the heavy air traffic. Sometimes a small plane or a passenger plane will veer off course, and they'll send interceptors out after them if they don't identify themselves. And that is what the shoot 'em down orders were revealed in 1952. That with all the UFO sightings, if you can't talk them down or if they don't identify themselves to protocol, then they were going to shoot them down.
Well, then it's
basically a no-fly zone. You're not supposed to be there. And if you do veer off course and you're radioed, you know, you have to identify yourself.
And if
not,
don't...
Now, this was pretty scary during the Cold War era because the United States was anticipating the Soviet Union of dropping atomic bombs on us. So The Air Defense Command was spring-loaded. I mean, they weren't fooling around. When a bleep came up, they didn't identify themselves, they were gone. That's what happened in July and August over the Capitol when they sent the Starfires out after them.
Now, on the evening of September the 12th, 1952, three objects dropped into the ADIZ, or that particular zone. Mm-hmm. What happened to these three objects?
Well, what I did, Dr. Bob, when I worked with my military buddies here in Florida, we had to recreate the scenario. That's why this book took so many years to figure out. We actually worked and backpedaled and worked in reverse. We knew what had happened in Flatwoods. We knew all of the sightings that went up and down the East Coast states, and we worked in reverse. Flatwoods was actually the end of the storyline. Stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Flatwoods was the end. We worked our way backwards and figured out the flight path trajectories of these three damaged objects. And when they were all drawn back off to the east, they all intersected 90 miles off of the coast, mid-Atlantic coast, 200 miles east of Washington. And this is the area where they all, the apex where they had all met, and then they shotgunned in different directions and came over the coast. The first object flew southwest. And we tracked it coming over the eastern seaboard, and it flew towards Tennessee. It actually flew nearly 100 miles through the no-fly zone of Oak Ridge National Laboratory, the no-fly zone. Nothing is supposed to go through there. This object came and made a beeline and headed directly towards Oak Ridge. The second object came in, and it headed northwest. And this is where all the Baltimore Sun and a lot of the local papers in Maryland had reported this object. It was flying treetop level, and it passed over Baltimore. That was the second object, and it flew northwest. And I was able to pinpoint 27 locations that it passed over during its flight path, which is quite a lot. Once you pick up the trail and you start connecting the dots, and you find the times in the newspapers and Project Blue Book, it sounds a lot easier than it was. But that's what happened. When that thing passed over Baltimore, it headed northwest, and it made a beeline and was targeting the Air Force Base at Wright Patterson, Wright Patterson Air Force Base. As that was approaching Wright Patterson Air Force Base, a third object kind of threaded the needle and came down the middle, and that passed over Washington, D.C., and the New York Times reported that as the flame over Washington. That was on September 13th. When I started researching all these the Flatwoods Monster stories, the Flatwoods Monster story did not appear in the papers for a couple days. It appeared in the local Charleston paper on the 14th, and then by the 15th, it had hit the press, major press, United Press, International, and there's a whole list of them. But anyways, what I found looking in the initial periodicals and newspapers were all these different headlines, and scores of Baltimoreans see meteor-like object in skies. Mystery light zipped through skies here, stirring mild furor. The list goes on and on. And one of my favorites is four states bombarded by meteor-like objects. Fireball shower city area. Mystery light zips through skies here. And I found tons of articles, not about the monster, but about this. And that's how we pinpointed all these different locations.
So these three objects, when they dropped down through the ADIZ, were fired upon.
That is what we believe happened, because once they came in over the United States and they crashed. All of these objects crashed. They were all in flames. They were flying at treetop level. They were exploding, and they were making repeated landings in isolated areas. And they were seen by thousands of people.
You certainly were. We'll return with our guest, Frank Ficino, Jr. of Braxton County Monster, Revised Edition, The Cover-Up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed 2012, flatwoodsmonster.com. How would you like to win a free copy of the book we're talking about, The Braxton County Monster, The Cover-Ups of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed by Frank C. Fascino, Jr., which you can purchase at flatwoodsmonster.com. Now, if you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you're going to win that book. Last week, Dr. Zahara Hieronymus hosted 21st Century Radio. What was the name of her first guest last week's show? You tell us the name of her first guest on hour one on Dr. Zoe's show last week, and you're going to be the winner. But you got to qualify. Here's how to do it. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
This is Peter Davenport, director of the National UFO Reporting Center. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we hope you'll stay tuned for our UFO reports.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, the Braxton County Monster Revised Edition, the cover-up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed 2012, flatwoodsmonster.com. Frank Fascino, Jr. is its author. He's with us tonight. Frank, in regards to the battle that ensued, that you believe ensued, what did America use to attempt to shoot down and to shoot down these UFOs, and were they successful?
Well, that's a good question, because a lot of people don't realize that in 1952, the Air Defense Command started using Mighty Mouse 2.75-inch rockets. They were folding fin aerial rockets, and they were about 4 feet in length, weighed close to 20 pounds, and they had a range of about 6,500 yards and an effective range of about 3.5 miles. And these were bad boys. They traveled at 2,500 feet per second. And during 1952, the United States Air Force had two rocket-bearing jets. They had the F-86D Sabre Dog, and that had 24 rockets, and that was in the lower body, the lower fuselage part of the jet. And what would happen is this elevator would drop down and they would fire out. We had the F-94C Starfire, and that was actually introduced in July of 52, and they were housed in four groups of six rockets behind retractable doors behind the nose of the jet. It had a big nose cone that was black. That's where the radar was. And the United States Navy had the Cutlass, the F-7U-3, and that had a belly pod that would attach to the lower portion of the jet. That was a cool-looking jet. It kind of looked like a bat. And it had 32 rockets, and it also had 20-millimeter cannons. This is what the Air Force had during that time, and this is what they were sending out during 1952. They were the top-of-the-line jets. These jets were not used in Korea during the Korean War. We always had our best jets around Washington, D.C., protecting capital. Mm-hmm. And these are the particular jets we had at that time. So on this particular night when these three damaged objects came in, or we left off before the break, when this third object called the Flame Over Washington by the New York Times and also the Wilma Washington Airy Meteor by Project Blue Book, when it passed west over Washington, it was dipping down and lifting up along its flight path, Dr. Bob. It was actually a treetop level at certain points over D.C. It was pretty low. It was From the witnesses I spoke to in Flatwoods, they estimated this craft about 32 feet long. It was oval shape. It was like a big egg, okay, like kind of like a football shape, and 16 to 18 feet tall. So this thing was a good size. It wasn't a meteor, because if a meteor had went down that size, it would have made a big hole. No sonic booms were noted that night. But this thing passed west over Washington, D.C., and as it passed over the Capitol area and continued west, the other two objects actually turned away from their targets. And I call them targets because that's what I was told they were. One UFO was gunning towards Oak Ridge. The other one was gunning towards Wright-Patterson. When the third one flew over Washington and wasn't intercepted and taken down over that area, the other two actually turned in reverse direction and went in the opposite directions. The one that flew over Baltimore, that I was able to track it over 27 locations, that turned away from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and it turned towards the northern West Virginia panhandle. It nearly collided with a passenger plane near the Wheeling, Ohio County Airport. It redirected south and it landed in Ogilvie Park, just outside of Wheeling. The other one actually touched down in Tennessee, short of Oak Ridge, just over the border in a little town called Arcadia. As the third object, the flame over Washington, was heading west, what was interesting, over a few minute period, and I got this actual information from Project Blue Book, there was 12 different UFOs that descended out of the sky and formed an aerial perimeter around the damaged UFO and followed it west. These UFOs were dropped over Virginia, Maryland, and Washington. They basically formed a horseshoe, and they followed this craft west, the damaged one. And it was amazing reading the different reports of the people that were watching these things just drop out of the sky. They were in fear for their life. They were scared what was going to happen if this thing, these things had touched down. You figure there's 12 of them over three states just dropping out of the sky. People are just driving along in their convertibles. People are walking their dogs and their kids and their baby strollers, and they're looking up in the sky, and these things are coming down to treetop level. And this was all in Blue Book. Nobody ever figured it out or bothered to look at it, and the answers were right there. So what I did is I plotted all these sightings around the D.C. area, and when this damaged craft flew west, it went into Virginia, and these UFOs that had descended throughout the Washington area actually lifted and went back up into the sky again. This damaged UFO continued over Virginia. It was sighted by an aircraft over Front Royal. It continued going west, and it went into West Virginia, hit northern Braxton County, and turned and went south. That is the point where the Braxton County monster story picks up with the kids playing football on the field. Nobody had ever figured out what was going on before that. So by working in reverse, we figured out by backstepping what actually occurred and where these UFOs came from and where they were going.
So it's a little bit of like reverse engineering here.
Now, yes, now that's how we figured it out. These things just didn't drop out of the sky and happen to land in Braxton County. We figured their flight paths out. And if you look at my master map on flatwoodsmonster.com, you could see it. There's a section there where it says quick link. And if you click on it, you can zoom in and you could scope around and you can actually look at it. The one UFO that really intrigued me was the one that flew over Baltimore.
Yep.
And
that's
you want
exactly
me to hit a couple
right
highlights of
yes,
Baltimore,
yes.
Son?
Yeah, we got about 4 minutes, so let's close out this hour with
okay,
Baltimore.
Okay, yeah, this is a good part here. Scores of Baltimoreans see meteor-like object in skies. What was it? It definitely was not an airplane streaking across North Baltimore, its engine on fire, and it was not a comet. It goes on and on. Not since Baltimore, with the rest of the world first began to read about flying saucers several years ago, has anything approached so close to what local residents considered the real thing made its appearance here. The first excited call came in a few minutes after 8 p.m., and they kept up for more than an hour. And then there's different people who had actually called in and gave their reports. Suddenly, this thing came swooping down from the eastern skies. It looked like it was right above the housetops. It was a ball of bright greenish fire with a long tail. Then there was an Army veteran driving along Cold Spring Lane near Lock Raven Boulevard. He wouldn't give his name, but he said it was a flying saucer. And it just goes on and on. He, like many others in that area, described this big thing as a greenish ball with a short red tail. Here's a really good one, Dr. Bob. To Herman Rosenthal, when he first saw it swooping at, quote, treetop height near his home in the 2700 block of Spring Hill Avenue, it looked at first like a plane on fire. This was your damaged object. And the article just goes on and on and on. And just talking about all these different sightings around the Baltimore area. And what I did is I actually tracked it after it passed over Baltimore. And as it went northwest towards the area of right past an Air Force base, what had happened is Baltimore being so close to the capital, Washington, D.C., there was actually an object that flew over Baltimore, and there was one that flew over Washington. The media had combined a lot of these sightings and thought it was one particular object. Mm-hmm. And then we have the one that went down towards Tennessee. So we actually had three of them. And everybody was confused over this. And subsequently, the Air Force said all of this was one object seen for 5 to 6 seconds.
Well, there are many things I learned from this book. I did not know that meteors have a 5 to 6, maybe up to a maximum 9 second life as they pass through the sky. Is that correct?
Right, right. And they
and this lasted for 21 hours.
Yeah, there was there's 21 hours of sustained UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm. Well, my favorite UFO sighting came later on in the 50s. It was the one out at, you probably know this one, of course, Lock Raven, where we had the reservoir, Lock Raven Reservoir. Arthur Godfrey talked about that an awful lot, about that sighting. As a matter of fact, I was out there. I didn't see it at that particular time, but it's one of those things that all of us in the neighborhood talked about frequently. Now, when we return, we've got a lot to cover here. There were also reported landings of these three objects, and also disappearances of some of them, which we're going to touch on. And then we need to return to, we'll get right to the Flatwoods Monster, because it really wasn't a monster, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was a mechanical hovercraft.
And we'll talk about that when we return here on 21st Century Radio with our guest Frank Fascino, Jr., the Braxton County Monster Revised Edition, the cover-up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed 2012, flatwoodsmonster.com.
Talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lucera.